We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon. And
tonight we are looking at yet another animated Doctor Who adventure, Dreamland, starring David Tennant as the 10th Doctor. In 1950s Southwest America, the Doctor arrives just near Area 51, where bug-eyed monsters, gray aliens, men in black, and psychotic military come together in a sort of conspiracy theory loonies big bowl of chili. And a diner. Let's not forget a 50s diner. Can the Doctor save the Earth once again? Okay, just go watch it. It's short. It's only 45 minutes. You can get the whole story such as it is. This is the first, well, I don't want to say the first computer animated, because Flash animation is sort of computer animation. But this appears to be the first CGI rendered animation.
It's 3D animation.
Yes.
It's interesting. This is 2009, and it was being made at the time when I was actually doing, as part of my master's degree, I did a module in 3D animation. I've forgotten most of what I learned now, anyway. But that was certainly very interesting to have the news of that being made while I was in the middle of learning how it actually all worked, and then to kind of watch it at the time through sort of moderately informed eyes in terms of the differences in the way that you construct a 3D animation from a kind of ordinary 2D animation. The technology that produces that, whether it's Flash or anything else, there's a great deal of similarity between all the 2D techniques, and then suddenly, bam, you're into the kind of post-Toy Story world of 3D.
Yeah, you've got to have all that three-dimensional cameras and stuff, which they probably, of all the things, I think they use that to the most effect, is some realistic shadowing, is the most eye-catching thing to me, difference between the 2 and 3D animation. It's most notable in the elevator scene, where they're going up in the lights and the shadows are lengthening and shrinking as they go by, but that's always been the thing that catches my eye in 3D animation, is the shadows.
It looks completely different to me, I have to say. It's just, I don't know whether this is, you know, because of those many hours I spent with Blender trying to recreate, or 3D Max I used, I think, trying to recreate the lamp from that first Pixar short. But when I look at something in 3D, with all of the perspective and everything, it just has a completely different feel and appearance. The thing I think there's some things you can do, because obviously, I mean, you mentioned the shadows. Well, you do a 3D scene, you've got to light it, and you can actually, the concept of camera work, you mentioned camera work, the concept of camera work suddenly has a meaning, because you actually do have a perspective, the kind of viewport through which you see everything matters, whereas the 2D version of it is still much more akin to drawing. It's like a kind of, well, it's a storyboard with motion, isn't it?
Right. So from your jaded eye as a seasoned professional.
Well, I'm not saying a seasoned professional. I'd say I did a spot of this in 2009, and I've forgotten
it. Was it good? Does this animation work for you?
If we're talking about the animation, because we've kind of gone through this progression of the previous, you know, three stories of fairly basic animation, three stories of much more impressive animation, albeit Flash animation. And this isn't Flash animation, so I know you should be impressed. But I thought The Invasion looked really nice in terms of the artwork. I thought this looked really impressive in terms of the actual scenes and some of the models in it, but I was really horribly, horribly distracted, and I do think this detracted a huge amount from it, by the actual animation itself, and particularly in the way, you know, the humans moved. You can get away with it, I think, to a large degree, if you've got enormous kind of insect-like aliens, because
you can naturally make up what they feel like, right?
Yeah. You can put down the way that they move either to the animation or to their physics, because they're not going to squash and stretch as much as a fleshy biped, because they're not constructed in the same way, or at least if that's how you interpret it, looking at it, that can work fine. But when you look at people running, you just think, well, they don't run like that. And I don't quite know what it was, whether there wasn't enough fluidity in the way the stretching of the models, and whether the rigging was just, you have to bear in mind that these things are done on a budget, and 3D animation for a 45-minute episode of Doctor Who is incredibly ambitious. Mm. When you consider that's more than half the running time of Toy Story, for example, and what that cost, and the sheer number of people involved in that, and the render farms behind it, and all the rest. So it would be completely unfair to expect that kind of quality from it.
But
at the same time, the people making these Doctor Who animations have made a choice to switch from 2D animation to 3D animation. And so if what that brings is a less convincing... I'm not quite sure
how to categorize it. Final product, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's the final product is less convincing, and in particular, it's because of the movement within it. And so if you're choosing to do that, then I think, you know, that you're going to get... You've got to take some criticism on that basis, because that is an artistic judgment. You're saying, we want to go 3D. There are reasons for going 3D, and the studio who did this, which incidentally is a Brighton-based studio called Little Loud, have done a great job on a lot of the artwork and everything. But if the constraints of budget, time, manpower and all the rest of it mean that the actual movements are not as good as they would have been if it had been a 2D version, then that is a compromise they've chosen to make, and I think it suffers.
So a couple of things. I mean, one, I'll come out and say I thought the invasion was better. Like I said, we've had that thing. I'm not crazy about flash animation, but I think it's more effective than this animation. I did not like this animation.
It's not just good for flash animation, then. We're starting to get a concession that it's good for animation.
I would still take any hand-drawn artwork animation over the invasion, because it still has a sort of computery look to me, and it's very hard to describe it, but it's really kind of like in the folds of the face on Patrick Troughton and things that it doesn't quite, you know what I'm talking about?
I know what you mean, but I'm imagining, you know, these kind of warehouses full of animators,
right?
The BBC have to find the budget for.
Exactly. So that's my next question: is Toy Story, the characters are not people, although I think there are a couple of humans in it. I've not actually seen it.
Yeah.
If you can believe that, the father of two kids. I haven't actually seen Toy Story. I managed to get out of the room for that. I've seen Wall-E.
God, you've really missed out.
And which is okay. But anyway. Should you try it? Is there a point where you should cut your losses and say, we just can't do this on the budget we have, that what we have isn't up to the task, and should they have cut the point here and said, let's stick with what we were doing before?
Yeah.
And then the second question is 3D animation actually more expensive than 2D? Because I don't see that there's any logical reason that it should be, because it is all just a computer-based process, so it's a time for the animator to build a model, and then the computer does a lot of... Well, I'm sure that it does the tweening in the flash animation, and I'm sure that it does much of the frame animation rendering with, you know, you're hitting points along the way, and then the computer is doing all of the render work. So is it really Is it really more expensive process? Yeah,
well, no, but it is slightly more expensive in computing terms. But where the cost really increase is in terms of the animation work that is involved, because you have to bear in mind that they've had to construct every model, and they've had to texture it, and everything has to be lit, and you have to have the cameras and everything. But where the kind of real labor comes in is you build these models that are going to have movement, that you're going to animate. Something like a car, okay, that's not too bad, because you've got kind of obviously the wheels move and various other bits on the car move, but they're a relatively simple kind of structure. But for an animal of any kind, and a human in particular, and you think about the face and the rest of it, once you've built the model, you've got a statue. What you've actually got to do is rig it, mm-hmm. so that the motion of any part of it, and yes, you can get the computer to interpolate between different states, but the way in which it does that depends entirely on the way it's rigged and the particular kind of kinematics you have associated with it. Doing that is the incredibly labor intensive part of the process.
Okay, so
I don't think there's any kind of real equivalent to that in 2D.
It is kind of hard for me to separate some of these, and of course look back through history and say, well, in 2009, A was possible, but in 2007, B wasn't possible, or whatever it happens to be. But I think, and I can't prove it, or even not even going to assert it for the invasion, but I can say that I'm quite positive that some of the later animations, the 2D animations, were done in 3D animation software. Because I've watched some of the documentaries, and so they're using exactly the same tools. They just are flattening it out in a three-dimensional model work for, like, the people. But then everything else, the rooms and things, are all rendered 3D models and whatnot. And it strikes me it's really just a blending of the two techniques are coming together, and I don't know that they've reached that at this 2009 point. But
I mean, I'd be very interested to know how they did the almost photorealistic backgrounds in the invasion of some of the things, like the building that you see in the live action episode.
I believe those are rendered three-dimensional images.
Yeah.
If we go forward to the Ice Warriors, that's what they did. We know that for the Ice Warriors, that they took set photos and they put them in a 3D and they rendered them into rooms. And then they planed the 2D animation.
You mean the computer modeled a 3D version of the room?
Yes.
By taking the data from a 2D photo?
Well, from the information that they had. Obviously, an artist worked it out. So
a human did it from a 2D
a
photo.
A human did it from 2D photos. Of
I thought you meant
sets.
The computer kind of was able to reconstruct.
But then somehow
just analyzing the photo.
Somehow then they put a plane in space inside that room, and that's what they animate the 2D characters upon.
Yeah.
It's an odd.
Well, either that, or you just take what is equivalent to a photo in the 3D environment, mm-hmm. and use it as your background for your 2D animation, which is one way of generating backgrounds.
So and I think we talked about this last time. There is a trend sometimes in comic books in which they have make people long and spindly and sort of funny shaped and distorted, and that's exactly what's wrong with these models here. David Tennant doesn't look right. He looks in that, okay, this is just a sort of, to me it looks like lazy. Well, I know it isn't. I know it's stylistic, but to me it's lazy drawing. It's like I'm a bad artist. I cannot draw. And so when I look at my drawing, I say, that's because you're a crap drawy person. And when I look at artwork like that, and everyone goes, wow, it's so amazing, I look at it and I go, that guy can't draw either. And that's...
I wouldn't. I mean, I thought that the doctor was... It was clear that the most time had been spent with the doctor, and obviously he gets the most kind of screen time and does the most talking, so the way his face moved and everything had been attended to. But the actual, if you freeze framed any, you know, you took the DVD and freeze framed any particular point in it, and I'd look at it and I would go, wow, yeah, that's pretty good. Including any shot with the people in it. It's the way the people moved. I mean, I didn't think the people were drawn quite as well as some of, say, the landscapes, which were pretty beautiful, or even some of the Area 51 interiors and this kind of thing. But it wasn't until you kind of press play again and you start to see the motion that, for me, the illusion is
lost. Yeah.
I wouldn't say shattered, but it certainly it loses a great deal from the fact that the figures have this kind of slightly jerky, very stiff way of moving around.
And there are two scenes in this thing that just jarred me horribly. One is they're in the spaceship, and when I don't think the jet fighters hit them, and Tennant's character goes, "Whoa!" And it's just his arms at the elbow flapping up.
Yeah.
Whoa! And then down again. Whoa! It's like, okay, that looks so bad. And the other, in particular, was when they walked into the TARDIS and Cassie, she's taking steps that look roughly like three-quarters size of a normal human step, but she's moving at about a quarter of the distance that she would.
Yeah, same thing in the store where the doctor goes with what's her name, the alien, and he's walking along in the same way.
Yeah,
but talking about the TARDIS interior, that's another really beautifully drawn or beautifully built bit model.
If they were planning on making more,
it would look great.
If they were making more, obviously spending time on the TARDIS model and the David Tennant model makes sense.
Yeah.
Because they're going to come back again. True.
But they didn't use the TARDIS a lot, so when they actually did go into the interior, I was quite impressed by how good it looked. But, yeah, I suppose you're right. It is possible they were thinking, if we're going to do any more of this, then we're reusing it.
Yeah, because if they didn't do a very good job on it, and then they came back in the next one, and it was all TARDIS-based, they just have to work harder to bring it up to snuff. So, yeah, it's fine. So, taking the animation aside, which I'm thinking we're both not a huge fan of, what about the story?
Well, I think there were flaws in the animation. It was good, and I would really not want to criticize the animators, but I think that they obviously did not have sufficient time to make the motion convincing, and that was such a serious flaw that it detracted from the whole thing.
Yeah.
So that's my criticism.
Again, we get episodes of Doctor Who. I'm not complaining exactly about it. It's just, you really can see the disconnect between it and even Toy Story. So, in the quality of it, and
Toy Story is setting a very, very high bar.
But then you've got the difference between, and again, I'm not like an animation fan, but so you have the difference between, say, Sleeping Beauty or Cinderella versus Scooby Doo, which is a horribly, horribly cheap animation, and yet I enjoy Scooby Doo a heck of a lot more because I enjoy the stories more. And so, what'd you think of this one?
Okay, so the story.
Yes.
It was kind of pacey and quite well constructed, though I think it probably suffered a bit from, again, this is one that was broadcast in 6 minute chunks.
That makes sense.
12 minutes, rather than, you know, building up. But at least they didn't try, you know, the Infinite Quest. Because the episodes all tried to be too distinct, and you had the different planets that they had to go to recover bits of the data doodah, at least this had a kind of coherence to it, because it was all set in the same, whatever it was, 2 or 3 miles of the Nevada desert. And it had the same more or less the same kind of cast of characters to it. So it was workmanlike, I would have said.
It was all over the place, though.
Well, I don't know, I thought the story, the construction of the story was okay. I mean, it wasn't very... I suppose one thing was it wasn't very original, which doesn't necessarily matter. In particular, it just really made me want to watch the X-Files episode of the same name, because...
Fallen Angel?
No, Dreamland.
There's one called Dreamland for X-Files too?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a two-parter, but the whole X-Files thing, you know, with going and finding Area 51 and the men in black and the conspiracy stuff and the two alien races fighting each other, so on and so forth. I think it's about as close as you could get without risking Chris Carter taking legal action against you.
It's pretty darn bog standard. Like I said, this is the conspiracy loonies playbook.
Yeah.
You know, this is what Area 51 is. So, I mean, I don't think Chris Carter had a leg to stand on, because he took that right out of the loony book. So,
yes, true.
And I mean, and obviously that was intended.
If Phil Ford says we're doing a kind of B-movie and the X-Files obviously riffed off a lot of that stuff themselves, that could be his get out of saying we're not copying the X-Files. But on the other hand, would he have done it if the X-Files hadn't done it first?
I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a lot of cultural baggage and mileage that's still associated with the Roswell incident, which, of course, they tied in here of sort of. You know, there wasn't much Roswell in this. Ooh, crashed in Roswell. Okay, moved to Area 51 kind of thing a few years later. But, that's there. I mean, that's ripe for Doctor Who to pluck on. So I don't have any problem with that. But it didn't really seem like they just threw everything in. Okay, we've got to throw in Roswell. We've got to throw in 51. We've got to have bug-eyed monsters. We have to have men in black. We have to have gray aliens. We have to have an actual flying saucer. I mean, it is like the... I don't know why this is going to happen, but it's going to happen again. I'm going to refer back once again to Dark Shadows, which has nothing to do with this, except that I happen to know that the way they did their stories during the soap opera years is they actually had a file, an index file, where somebody's job was to just go through and watch things and read things and go, okay, vampire, werewolf, zombie, voodoo curse, and they just put these on cards, and then they would go to them and pull them out and, you know, kind of rifle through them and say, oh, this is a good one to pick today, because we just need to keep it going and going. And I feel like somebody was doing that with a list and said, what do we do here? Bug-eyed monsters, green aliens, Area 51, Roswell. Okay, good, we're set. Take it. Write a story. And the story feels that well organized to me, which is not at all, because it does feel like we're bouncing from one, you know, the men in black, they really weren't necessary in this story. They felt shoehorned in. I think just the military working this would have been fine. The fact that they're actually men in black for one side, but they've been co-opted to work for the other side, and we don't even know who the first side is. I'm not saying I didn't necessarily think they were realized well. It's just a piece too many.
I enjoyed
the swarm alien, the brain scorpion flies, or whatever it was. Again, it was like,
I'll give you that one. The men in black I liked. The swarm alien thing.
But we need a little bit of danger here.
Take a shopping list or whatever, and or take all these, what I still think they're X-Files ingredients, and construct it into some kind of narrative with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I think Phil Ford's done a reasonable job on doing that. The real criticism I have of the story that kind of undermined its overall enjoyability was that I didn't think there were enough. There wasn't enough in the characterization. There weren't enough characters who we might care about. And that's a particular problem when you don't have a companion for the Doctor, because then you've got the kind of temporary companions who are Cassie and, God, I can't even remember the idiot's name.
Right.
But
Johnny
Jimmy,
Ironjacket.
Jimmy. Absolutely the most extremely stupid character ever depicted on television, probably. I mean, what a pillock. I didn't find myself involved in any of the characters, and although it was obviously kind of 3D animated, I thought that Aslock and Stark and so on were totally two-dimensional in terms of their characterization.
Okay, one thing, we did have this discussion last time, I admitted fully and freely that I cannot instantaneously pick out Anthony Head's voice, but I sure can pick out David Warner's.
Oh yeah,
that is just like, David Warner.
Now he's that got one, a great voice.
That one I catch every time, and I mean he's in a lot of Big Finish stuff too.
I tell you whose voice I missed, and I usually pick out because, she appeared in Survival on TV's Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
But she's a kind of Big Finish favourite because their first series was the Bernie Summerfield stories based on the spin-off books that were a book companion for the Seventh Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So her voice is incredibly familiar to Big Finish listeners in particular. That's Lisa Bowerman, who was Saruba Valak. And
oh, you got her name this time.
Yeah, yeah. I wrote it down so I'd remember it. And I didn't recognise it. I mean, there's a bit of treatment on it. And when I went back and listened to it, I was like, oh, yeah, of course. But I was quite surprised to miss that.
I didn't pick it up, but that name doesn't ring a bell. I mean,
if you've listened to a few of the Benny Summerfield stories, or even actually there's a wonderful spin-off with Jago and Lightfoot from the Talons of Wen Chiang, and they often meet in the Red Tavern where the barmaid Ellie is also played by Lisa Bowman. So
she's probably been another Big Finish as well. And I just,
oh yeah,
I just don't recognize. And as you point, it was treated,
Terror, I think.
And she only had about five, six lines, I guess, in the whole thing. My husband, I can treat him in my spaceship. Yeah. It wasn't.
Or your plan is to be a snail.
Yeah. So it wasn't.
Yeah. Fair enough. And Stark was Stuart Milligan, who was
Goonshaw, right? No.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, that's Spike
S. Milligan. he was Nixon in the wonderful, wonderful, wonderful two-parter, Day of the Astronaut, and
Show the Moon. Yeah, he was the he was the best part, I think. anyway, yeah. Yeah, so it was a diverting 45 minutes, but it did feel like it had some issues.
I wanted to ask how the American accents compared to.
I was going to ask you if David Tennant's Mockney grates on you like his Howdy partner did on me when he walked in the door. that was appalling.
But that wasn't supposed to. I mean,
I don't think it was supposed to be good, but it was. Really, he's like, oh, please don't talk like this for the rest of it. Please don't. Like the episode where he did the Scottish thing in Tooth and Claw, and you thought, well, his Scottish isn't very good, I suppose. But yeah.
You thought his Scottish wasn't very good.
It doesn't sound at all like Mr. Scott on Star Trek, which is obviously the holotype for Scottish accents.
Yeah, it's funny because if you watch any of the Confidentials or anything, David Tennant likes to do that fake Scottish accent all the time when he's interviewed. It's very odd.
I know. He's having fun with him. I know. No, I mean,
mine's gone blank.
Cassie's accent.
Yeah, what's her name?
Yeah, Georgia Moffat.
Georgia Moffat,
obviously, we know enough about her to know that she has some exposure to American English in her upbringing.
Of course, because her mom is,
yeah. I'm going to tell you that I think her mom has a terrible American accent, and I know she's American. So when I listen to her on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I feel like she's putting on something.
Like, don't if I, listen, like you if don't I was listen putting to her on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. She appeared in the TV version.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Trillium was played by a different actress in the radio.
Right, I mean the TV version.
Oh, I see. So
that's
listen,
what I saw. Yeah, at
so
first,
listen while you're watching. Yeah, sorry. Yes. Yeah, I was thinking listen as in listen to the.
I feel like she's putting. It's if I were to put on a New York accent and try to change my voice like this, and it doesn't sound like a real New Yorker, even to me. But I don't feel like she's talking naturally, and I don't know what that is. And of course, that's her mom. So if that's her real accent, and Georgia got her accent from listening to Mom, it doesn't sound quite right. It doesn't sound horrible, but it does sound somewhat. Jimmy, what's his name, sounded better. But then that's because he was putting on his famous, you know, his fake Native American accent. So,
he wasn't played by a Native American. I didn't know who the actor was who played him. So,
yeah, and that is a little condescending. His accent too, but as someone who has official paperwork to say I am a Native American, I'm allowed to find the whole Native American sub thing here a little bit. Really, bows and arrows? Come on. Yes, in the 1950s, they were still running around with bows and arrows.
No, they weren't.
And at least they didn't go into any kind of wacky mysticism stuff. I hate the wacky mysticism stuff with the Native Americans. At least it was just, hey, we're decent people. We found a wrecked spacecraft and we've been trying to help this person. That part I was fine with. But it did the whole thing did seem just sort of right out of a British interpretation of a foreign country.
They should have had the voiceovers like, you know, on the third day, the FBI man, all that stuff from the X-Files.
I hate that.
The Time Lord came and...
Yes, I can see that, actually, in our oral history that we pass down throughout the rest of time, because we can't afford computers or or paper and stuff. Yeah, no, that's... It wasn't as bad as it could have been, but it really felt like it was going there, particularly when we first introduced the character, and he's in the... in the diner, and he's just doing that sort of stereotype accent that, you know, may have been real. It doesn't matter. But it's still a stereotype kind of thing. And like, oh, please, please, I don't want to hear anything about medicine men or the great sky spirits or anything like that or totems. I just, you know, do not go there. And well, it wasn't too bad except for the bows and arrow thing, but. Otherwise, and of course the general didn't. Yeah, I would never have picked him out as being Nixon. I didn't give it much thought. He kind of sounded like a standard general stereotype. So
I wouldn't have recognized him by voice alone.
No. An American general playing that kind of hard nosed, or an American actor playing that kind of hard nosed military kind of guy would kind of put on that demeanor, so that throws the accent off. So they were all right. I mean, hey, well, you know, it's the first time the doctor has been. Well, no, it's not the first time the doctor's been to America. They had that wonderful gunfighters, and let's not forget the
Daleks
the chase.
In
yeah, the chase. Yeah,
no, was it Evolution of the Daleks? Daleks in Manhattan. Yeah,
Daleks in Manhattan. Evolution of the Daleks, and there was or Evolution of the Daleks. Then there was also that time when it must have been the chase. When they arrived on the Empire State Building, and the actor who played Steven did that really wonderful American accent in that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That was good.
It was an improvement. I think they have improved. I made my own point. They have improved. It's gotten better over the years. So, who knows? Someday they might hire an American actor. Although the guy who plays Ed Straker is dead now, and the other American actor that works over there, who was like the guy that's in like every James Bond film for years and years. You know who I'm talking about? The sub commander in The Spy Who Loved Me. And he was, I think he was one of the guys on the mission control at Moonraker. I mean, he was in everyone. Ed Bishop really had the lion's share of American actor roles for a long time in Britain.
Ed Bishop did the Philip Marlowe stories on the radio, And then obviously after he died, they couldn't use him when they wanted to do a new series of
Fair enough.
So they had Toby Stevens, who is an American player.
Toby Stevens, I know that name.
He was in Vexed. Did you see Did you get Vexed over there? That was a great Howard Overman series.
No, I haven't got that one.
Or at least the first series was. The second was rubbish. He was in that awful Die Another Day as the baddie.
That's where I know him from. Okay.
Though he has also played James Bond on the radio. So.
Oh, wait a minute.
So James Bond and Philip Marlowe.
I think I've heard the James Bond ones. The radio James Bond ones.
Yes.
That's
well, they might well be the Toby Stevens ones.
That actually sounds like it fits. Yeah. What else have we got on this this show, if anything? I hear the birds chirping in the background, saying, "Nope, got nothing."
Yeah. It was pretty. I don't know. It's pretty inconsequential. I mean, I thought that the kind of story structure was an improvement over the Infinite Quest. The Infinite Quest was
too broken up.
And so it kind of came near the bottom of the pile in its, you know, if you compare it to the third series episodes, and this was a special in the year of the specials, and it's nowhere near as bad as The End of Time. I think that's probably the nicest thing I can say about it.
Okay, it is nowhere near as bad as The End of Time. It's an inconsequential level. We didn't learn anything new about the Time Lords. No. We didn't get angst for the
Very
Doctor.
Very few of the episodes I like involve learning more about the Time Lords.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I thought the episode that preceded it, which was also partly written by Phil Ford, The Waters of Mars, was hugely, hugely better.
I put that as one of the top four in the season of specials, yeah.
Generous.
I've never sat down to rate those. I'm going to guess off the top of my head, I probably would put The Water of Mars at the top of them. I can only think of The Flying Bus and The End of Time right off the top of my head as the other
two.
There's
the Next Doctor as well.
Oh, is that part of it?
I don't know whether that counts as or whether that.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to say Waters of Mars. Yeah, was
I like? I mean, I did think the specials overall were underwhelming, and you know, it was really the Day of the Doctor that has confounded my opinion on specials in general. But Waters of Mars was pretty good.
Waters of Mars will always have a place in my heart, as it is absolutely the first episode of Doctor Who I was ever able to watch live via the BBC.
Wow.
Everything else prior to that had been reruns or may have been found somewhere on the internet or something, but that one was for real time. That was a heck of a treat. That was a whole family event, sitting here on the TV watching this. It was like, I can't believe we're actually managing to do this. Isn't technology wonderful? Well, so what do we have for our next animated adventure of Doctor
Who? Well, it's an interesting little story called The Reign of Terror.
Okay. Now, have you watched it?
No.
You have
not yet.
Not okay.
I will watch it before we discuss it, because I feel it would be worth being informed about. But I know it's one of the ones that I've been saving. So all of the remaining animations that we have left to discuss are reconstructions of episodes that were lost, and they're all serials that I haven't seen. I have listened to the audio from The Tenth Planet, so I do know that story, but I think all of the others are going to be new stories to me, as well as not having seen the animation.
Okay, that will be interesting. I have seen them, but that's because I have no self-control. I literally had all of them ordered on Amazon. I even have The Underwater Menace ordered on Amazon, waiting for that to come out someday. I think they may have finally canceled it and said, we just don't think
they
we're going to get it.
They have canceled it, yeah.
But Well, I don't know.
Oh, you mean have Amazon canceled it?
Has Amazon canceled it? That's right. I don't know that they have. I mean, you don't. They don't charge you for it. But so when they would have the release schedule of those, I would put them down and say, just send it to me so that on release day it's on my doorstep, and which Amazon's really good about. And so the day they came out, I came home, I watched them. It just wasn't. I was like, this is new Doctor Who episodes I've never seen. I can't possibly wait. So I have watched them all, but I will rewatch them, even Reign of Terror. Before
you're not filling me with enthusiasm.
I don't want to kill the buzz for the rest of the project. Some of them are great, and it's not the animation. Anyway, all right. Well, Simon, thank you for joining me.
It's been a pleasure as always.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com, find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolfe.